Why is it in our society it's so difficult to talk about grief and loss? What has been your guys' experience that makes things difficult?
Okay.
Yeah, it's difficult to explain to other people because a lot of times when we're in grief, we don't understand what it's like. And it's a little frustrating to talk to someone about their grief and their emotions because it's hard enough for me to talk about my own emotions and deal with them, but now I'm dealing with somebody else. It's just not part of who we are, I think, a lot of times to talk about what some people might consider negative events or negative things in their life. This is a picture, I think people go to extremes. This is a picture I saw in a castle in Wales when I was on vacation a few years ago. And the tour guide told us that the family who owned this castle or whatever, they actually had 5 children, but 2 of them died in a plague. So the parents just had the other 2 children painted out of the picture. And if you look really close at the picture in person, you can kind of see the outlines of the 2 other children. This is a license plate I saw when I was on vacation in Virginia last year, where this person kind of went to the other extreme and have taken on the identity of being a griever. Now, maybe this is the person's last name. I've never heard of that before. But here it's like, I'm a griever. So what do these 2 pictures tell us? Well, first, it tells you what it's like to go on vacation with me, that there's always kind of a grief component involved in that. But it shows how people go to extremes. Either you want to blot out the bad situation and never think about it, or you take it on as an identity, and that's who you are for the rest of your life. And so what we want to do is we want to help people incorporate their grief into their life. One of the examples that we use in our ministry is that of an onion, that when you take an onion and you put it, isolate it, put it in a dark cupboard, it has these weird things sprouting out of it and it turns kind of moldy and everything. But when you bring it out to the light and you cut into it, what happens? You start crying because the onion is very pungent and it makes you cry. But when you chop that onion up and saute it and you put it in a casserole or you put it in a dish, it flavors that dish. When you taste the dish, you're not actually thinking, oh, there's onion in this. It just has a good flavor to it. And that's what we want to help people do, is to incorporate their grief into their life so it flavors their life. It makes them more meaningful, more accessible to other people, more human. It's difficult, though, because I think throughout our lives, we're taught how to acquire stuff, not how to lose it. We're taught how to get good grades, how to get a job, how to find a spouse, how to win a football team, how to buy a house. But nobody really trains us or teaches us how to lose things. So when you do lose a job or a game or something, you don't have a category necessarily for that. You don't have a good example for that. I think one thing that parents can do, this is a whole other topic, is but to teach your kids how to be good losers, how to lose something, you know, and not have that devastate you. So what is grief? When we talk about the word grief, I think it's important that we define grief properly because that's going to influence how we respond to grief and how we then attempt to alleviate not only our own grief but other people's grief. Because if we believe that grief is just sadness, then our goal is going to be just to create happiness, just to make yourself happy, to make the other person happy. If we believe that grief is just sorrow because you've lost something, then we're going to try to replace it. Not necessarily with another person, but maybe with a cause. A lot of times someone loses a loved one to a type of cancer, and then they become this big advocate, you know, for breast cancer or whatever, which is a good thing to do. It can be very good. But if you're doing that to replace what you've lost, you need to stop first and process. And if you believe that grief is just a temporary interruption to endure, then you're just going to tough it out. One of the major myths about grief is that it lasts a year. And so some people feel like, if I just make it through this first year, I'm going to be okay. And that's just not really valid. So here's a definition of grief. It's grief is a normal and natural response we experience when we lose someone or something that has meaning in our life. So loss is involved here. And it is normal and natural. There's a lot of controversy or discussion these days about grief being a diagnosed condition. And I really kind of push back against that. I think grief can bounce off of other types of conditions, but grief itself is normal. When someone tells me, oh, my dad died, but it really didn't bother me that much, you know, I'm just like, I don't know about that. I think we all experience grief in some ways. And grief results from a loss or a transition. And some transitions also produce joy. When you think of graduating from college, it's like, woohoo, I'm done with school, I don't have to study anymore, I don't have to take tests anymore. But the other side of that is that, oh my God, now I have to go get a job. I don't have spring break anymore. I have to get up every morning. So one event can cause both joy and sadness. And I think we've talked about this in our fellowship a lot, about being able to have those two things, you know, coexist together. Here's a quote from one of the Lemony Snicket books, which is a great authority on life. It says, "The death of a loved one is like walking up the stairs to your bedroom in the dark and thinking there is one more stair than there is. Your foot falls down through the air, and there's this sickly moment of dark surprise as you try and readjust the way you thought of things." Have you ever had that feeling where you're walking upstairs and you put your foot down and there just isn't anything there? And you're off balance. And that's what it's like to be in grief. You're off balance. And as a friend of someone who is in grief or a leader of someone who's in grief, we want to help people get their balance back. Learn how to not get back to the way they were before, because they'll never be the same, but to learn now what their new normal is, what their new balance is. It's important, too, to understand that there is a difference between grief and mourning. I think everybody experiences grief. We experience it on a daily basis. But a lot of times people don't mourn. And mourning is being able to express that grief, to get it out somehow. And you do that through talking with people, through journaling. Some people write poetry. Some people write songs. You think of some of the best songs are about breakups and disasters. If it weren't for grief, we probably wouldn't have country music, because it's so much about bad things that happen to people. And so again, as a friend of someone in grief, one of our goals is to help people mourn, to be there, to help them express, to know it's okay to express their grief, and to really encourage them in those lines. So how does grief affect us? Because it does impact on more. Sometimes people think it's just sadness, but it affects us in many different ways. Here's a quote from professor of psychiatry who's pretty famous. She says, "The best way to understand how grief can affect your health is to understand what bereavement entails. One, it's a major stressor, and two, it's a loss of a close relationship. Close relationships help regulate our daily psychological and physical functioning. Their loss typically leaves people feeling out of control and disoriented." So what happens in grief is that you lose something that you're kind of dependent on or you look to, and then that person isn't who's normally there to help you through a stressful situation is no longer there. I have a little video here that I got off the internet that talks about just some of the effects that how grief affects our brain.
When we're grieving a profound loss, we often say we're heartbroken, but it might be more accurate to call it brain broken, given the role the brain plays in grief. As your brain adjusts to the loss of someone you love, you might feel numb, depressed, or foggy. But moving through the stages of grief is natural and healthy. It helps you process your loss and begin to move forward over time. This is Your Brain On, where we explore how the world affects our brains and ourselves. The experience of grief is twofold: the immediate acute pain of the loss and the months afterward as you mourn. The loss of someone meaningful functions as a stressor, triggering the pituitary gland at the base of the brain to produce adrenocorticotropin, or ACTH. ACTH sends a signal to the adrenal gland to release cortisone, a stress hormone. Unlike, say, a temporary threat, grief is an intense, persistent stressor, so your body remains flooded with cortisone. That can cause your immune system to falter, making you feel run down. This is likely why some bereaved spouses fall ill soon after their partner dies. Even if the death of your loved one was expected, the actual event can still feel like a shock to the system. In the short term, a traumatized brain is bottom-heavy, meaning primitive areas, including the fear center, are overactive, adding to feelings of stress and despair. Meanwhile, higher cortical areas of the brain are underactive, like the anterior cingulate cortex, which helps regulate emotion. You may find it difficult to let go of minor annoyances or experience symptoms like increased heart rate for several minutes after you're startled. However, over time, the initial shock of the loss typically gives way to a deep sadness or depression as you continue to mourn. Depression can cause widespread changes across several parts of the brain, including the amygdala, which regulates sleep behavior and mood, and the hippocampus, which processes memory and regulates stress hormones. These changes disrupt core functions of our bodies and minds. As you grieve, you may find yourself sleeping too little or too much, forgetting things, or trapped in a brain fog. These feelings are difficult, but the acute pain doesn't last forever. Eventually, the sadness begins to lift at least a little bit, and then you may move on to feelings of anger or guilt before slowly moving toward acceptance of the loss. Experts agree the bereaved follow their own individual timelines, but in general, this three-stage process usually takes about a year. There are steps you can take to feel better as you go through the grieving process. Talk therapy can be a major help. This might be group bereavement meetings or cognitive behavioral therapy, which can redirect negative thoughts. Aerobic exercise can improve mood, memory, and thought processing. Talking with friends about the person you lost can be a great comfort too. Studies show long-term grief actually activates neurons in the reward centers of the brain. And recalling the time spent with those who have died reminds us that the memories still live on.
So I think that gives a good summary of what happens in your brain. I like this little video, but the thing I don't like about it is that it has an older person who's the person grieving, and I'm involved with a lot of college ministry people. You'd be surprised how many people under the age of 25 have already lost both of their parents. And so there's just a lot of grief there. The other thing I talked about, that grief usually lasts about a year. In my opinion, grief lasts at least a year, because you have to get through each one of those Christmases, holidays, birthdays, anniversaries. But a lot of times people feel like the second year can be just as rough or even rougher, because the first Christmas you're still kind of in a fog and not finding your way, and the second Christmas maybe you're more aware of what's going on. And now with children in the class I teach, we do like a whole hour talking about children. But here's just some of the symptoms that with children, specifically clinginess, regression in school, in sports, acting out, things to look for. And also grief causes what we call secondary losses. If grief was only one emotion, it would be so much easier to deal with. But it's all these different emotions, but it's also a loss of identity, of security, support, the future. You think of someone who loses a spouse. You know, they're no longer a husband or a wife. You know, maybe they were dependent on their spouse for income and security, for support, and they had this future planned of retiring together, going on vacation together. And each one of these aspects is something we talk about in our workshop, because I think you have to grieve each thing. We have people write down, what are your secondary losses? You know, what has changed today because your loved one is gone? What would be different if your loved one was still here? So let me talk about a few things that complicate our understanding of grief, because I think we all have been ingrained since childhood in different ways of thinking. And so there are subtle things that we hear as children and we don't know how to process, but then they kind of come back up during times of grief. I mean, how many people have heard or have said themselves, when something bad happens, don't cry? So how does the child interpret this or process this? It's like, oh, okay, I'll just bury my emotions. I won't think about my emotions. Or the parent, when the kid is going through a rough time, says, oh, don't be sad. Let me bake you some cookies to give you here. And so the child is thinking, oh, the way you deal with bad situations is you just pleasure yourself. You just distract yourself. Or when a child has a broken toy and the parent just says, oh, don't worry, you know, we'll just buy you a new one. Or your dog dies and the parent says, oh, we'll just go buy a new dog. I think subconsciously it kind of teaches us that things are replaceable. And then the last one I had was just, you know, keep your feelings to yourself. And so the child's going to think that it's not safe to share your emotions. And I got some of these from a book where the author was talking about, but he had these ideas as a child. And so when he went through a divorce, you know, that subconsciously these came up. And so he's like, well, you know, cookies don't really do it for me anymore. So he started drinking alcohol. And he lost his wife because she ran out on him. He says, oh, I'll just go get a new wife. And he said he ended up becoming an alcoholic and getting divorced for the second time. And so we have to kind of fight against some of these misconceptions we have. Also, I think we have a lot of misconceptions about what is God's role. You know, I thought God was supposed to protect me. I think sometimes for followers of Christ, we might have more of a difficult time with grief because we have these expectations on God. If you're an atheist and you have no belief in God, and a car hits your child, you know, you don't have anybody to be angry at or to be confused about. And so I think in grief, we ask this question, why me? In our last workshop, I think I talked with a lot of people that it wasn't the why me question, but it was why now? Why did my dad die a week before my wedding? You know, why did my mom die, you know, 2 weeks before my wife gave birth? Here's a quote from Larry Crabb. He says, it's so natural to think the presence of Jesus has no greater purpose than to improve the quality of our journey through life, with quality defined as a pleasurable, satisfying, self-affirming existence, a journey where certain things don't go wrong, or if they do, they correct themselves. Another quote from Dr. Crabb is that he talks about how God's love doesn't anesthetize us from the pain, but it sustains us in the middle of the pain. And that's what God does. When we look at the 23rd Psalm, it talks about walking through the valley of the shadow of death, not walking around it, or, you know, God could show us a shortcut through the valley, but we need to walk through the valley. And you think of the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God could have stopped them from being thrown into the furnace. He could have stopped the fire from, you know, lighting the pilot light to go out or something. But instead, he was there in the furnace with them. And we'll talk a little later that that's kind of one of our roles, is to be with people while they're in pain. So our goal is not to take away someone's pain, but it support them as they go through that. I have another little video here, and then we'll talk a little bit about this idea of acknowledgement and how important it is. Hopefully we won't get a commercial with it, but maybe we will.
Many people don't know this, but if you qualify for this new offer through Pink Energy, you could get paid over.
So what do we do about all the pain we see in the world? All the pain we feel in our own lives? And why does it seem like our best efforts to help somebody feel better always backfire? I've been studying intense grief and loss, baby death, violent crimes, accidents, suicides, and natural disasters. And I've learned something really interesting. Cheering people up, telling them to be strong and persevere, helping them move on, it doesn't actually work. It's kind of a puzzle. It seems counterintuitive, but the way to help someone feel better is to let them be in pain. This is true for those giant losses and the ordinary everyday ones. Educator Parker Palmer writes, "The human soul doesn't want to be advised or fixed or saved. It simply wants to be witnessed exactly as it is." He's talking about acknowledgement here. Acknowledgement is this really amazing multi-tool. It makes things better even when they can't be made right. For example, somebody's struggling. Their baby died, or there's been a bad accident, or their mom got sick, and they're just sad. It's way more helpful to join them in their pain than it is to cheer them up. But here's what we tend to do instead. "You have two other children, you need to find joy in them." Or, "You know what you need? You just need to go out dancing and shake it off." Or, "I felt really sad once. Did you try acupuncture?" We're not really sure what to do with someone's pain, so we do what we've been taught. We look on the bright side. We try to make people feel better. We give them advice. It's not like this is nefarious. I mean, we try to cheer people up because we think that's our job. We're not supposed to let people stay sad. The problem is, you can't heal somebody's pain by trying to take it away from them. Now, acknowledgement does something different. When a giant hole opens up in someone's life, it's actually much more supportive to acknowledge that hole and let pain exist. It's actually a radical act to let things hurt. It goes against what we've been taught. In order to really support you, I have to acknowledge that things really are as bad as they feel to you. If I try to cheer you up, you end up defending yourself and your feelings. If I give you advice, you feel misunderstood instead of supported. And I don't get what I want either, because I wanted you to feel better. It's pretty rare that you could actually talk somebody out of their pain. Rarely does the admonishment to look on the bright side actually heal things for someone. It just makes them stop telling you about their pain. It's so tempting to try to make things better. When somebody shares something painful, it's much more helpful to say, "I'm sorry that's happening. Do you want to tell me about it?" To be able to say, "This hurts," without being talked out of it, that's what helps. Being heard helps. It seems too simple to be of use, but acknowledgement can be the best medicine we have. It makes things better, even when they can't be made right.
So it's talking about just how important it is that we can be in someone's life just to listen. This Wednesday in class, we're doing a whole section just on active listening, because that's so important to be able to listen without trying to fix someone. Here's a quote from Paul Tripp. He says, "Personal ministry is not about always knowing what to say. It's not about fixing everything in sight that is broken. Personal ministry is about connecting people with Christ so that they are able to think as he would have them think, desire what he says is best, and do what he calls them to do, even if their circumstances never get fixed." Sometimes we're hesitant to talk to people because we don't know what to say, you know? We want to fix them. But acknowledgement is just so important. And Tripp goes on, he says, "We forget that God's primary goal is not changing our circumstances or relationships so that we can be happy, but changing us through our situations and relationships so that we will be holy. And so I think that kind of summarizes, you know, how we can help other people to help them in understanding going through grief. Here's my last little video from Dr. Crabb about trying to fix people.
Never lead a group with the intention of fixing anybody, because you can't do it. Rather than fixing what's difficult, release what's alive. There's a real difference in the two. I think when a group leader's vision is what I can do for this person, they're putting pressure on themselves to handle it really well and to say all the right things. And then they're going to get all tripped up in their own need to be important to somebody else. And they're going to try to fix them with all the right clever sentences and the right Bible verses and all this sort of thing. And when I sense that you're trying to fix me and change me from where I am, I automatically resist you. Because I know ultimately you don't have the power to fix me, but you do have the power to be with me. And fixing versus withness is a profound shift. When I have somebody who, when I share what's wrong with me or my struggles and my grief and my resentment in the middle of my bitterness, in the middle of whatever I'm going through, and I sense that you feel the pressure now to get me to change, I realize you're not there for me. You're really there to, this will sound unkind, but you're there to look good yourself. The most power that I have is the power to be profoundly with them in the process that God is up to. Rather than giving suggestions and being full of advice, well, now, have you prayed about it? Are you engaging in spiritual disciplines? Are you doing this? Are you doing that? Here's some verses to memorize. Not that those things are bad, but they can easily come out as, here's the fix-it mentality. But rather than those kind of questions, what would it be like to say, tell me where you are right now? I think one of the things for an effective conversation that matters in a group or one-on-one is to explore what's happening between us in the moment. What's it like for you to sit here right now talking about your grief? Tell me what's happening in you. God says, I'm going to be with you, Emmanuel. God with us. I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. I'm going to be with you. I'm not going to solve your problems right now, but I'm going to be with you in the middle of them. Can I represent that kind of attitude when I'm sitting with you in a group?
So I think that talks points out pretty well the idea of what does it mean to, well, now I'm, want to go backwards. Trying to help someone. If I come to, I think we feel this pressure naturally. If I come to you and tell you that my sink is dripping, my faucet's broken, there's this implication that I'm asking you for advice on how to fix my faucet, or I wouldn't say anything to you. But if I come to you and I tell you that my heart is broken, I'm not asking for you to fix me or to give me advice. I just want you to listen. And so as leaders, as friends of people, we need to develop this, particularly in the early days of grief, to be able to listen to people and help them through. And this is what I call developing a paraclete lifestyle, to be that comforter and helper that the Holy Spirit is to us, for us to be that to other people. When you think about the story of Moses and how in the battle when Moses held his hands up, you know, that they were being successful, but then it says that his hands were heavy. It's what someone in grief feels like. They just are heavy. They're burdened. They want to sit down. And so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other, and thus his hands were steady until the sun set. And so they were being a paraclete to Moses. When you look at the word paraclete in the Greek, and in the Latin, it means a comforter, an advocate, an intercessor, a helper, one who comes alongside. And that's what we want to be to other people. I've done several training with a guy, Alan Wolford, out in Colorado. And one of his main principles for lay people is to be this idea of being a companion. I think when Larry Crabb was at Summer Institute, he talked about if the body of Christ was doing its job, that like 75% of his clients wouldn't need to come to see him. Mm-hmm. Because some people just need a friend. They just need someone to walk alongside them. So in 1 Thessalonians, it talks about, we urge you, brethren, to admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. And I think one part of this verse tells us that there is no cookie-cutter way to minister to people. We have to minister to people as individuals. We're going to admonish the unruly, but we're going to encourage the faint-hearted. And we need to be able to have good discernment, to really pray about people that we understand so that we can minister to them. If you think of Mary and Martha, here are two sisters. They're both grieving the same brother. They both come to Christ and say the exact same words, but yet Christ responds differently to each one of them. One, he engages in a conversation, eternal perspective. The other, he just sits and cries with. And so we need to be able to discern, you know, what that person needs and what they're, how to help them. So here's another verse from 1 Thessalonians. It says, "For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory." This is a verse that's really impacted me, that I have come up with ways to help people in grief. I've created this using the words of Paul, so it's spiritual. I've created this pyramid of support. And so the baseline of all support has to be comfort. You know, when people are in those initial stages of grief, you don't want to start urging them. But too often, people jump to the urging. You should do this. You should do this. You should, you know. And people can't hear that. They're not ready to hear it because we need that baseline of comfort. Even for encouragement, then, to move forward in encouragement. And I really think that urging or admonishment is pretty rare. And that's only in rare circumstances and only with deep types of relationship. One thing we talked about in class last week was understanding your relationship with the person in grief and understanding the relationship the person in grief had with the person that they've lost. So we want to watch out to be sure that we're comforting people before we encourage them. And I think a good example of this is from 1 Kings 19, where we see how God ministers to Elijah during a time of grief. I think probably most of us know the story of Elijah and how this great, you know, demonstration of God occurred. And yet Jezebel, the queen, vowed to kill Elijah, and he feared, and so he ran off. And so the scripture tells us, it says, Elijah was afraid, and he ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. Now, this is kind of typical of people in grief. They're going to isolate themselves. They're going to leave their friends behind. And so we need to watch out for this. Isolation can be good when it's for reflection. But we see this here in Elijah. It says, "Then he came to a broom bush and sat down under it and prayed that he might die. 'I've had enough, Lord,' he said. 'Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors.' Then he laid down under the bush and fell asleep." So the first thing I want to point out that God did for Elijah, ministered to him, is he gave him rest. Rest is so important for people in grief. Grief takes so much energy, emotionally, physically, that you're just tired. And then when you do lay down, a lot of times you just can't sleep. And I've talked to several people when I pointed this out, and they're like, wow, you know, I have been so tired and run down for the ever since my dad died, and I just can't figure out why I'm so tired. Or I've heard stories of people, like someone in a ministry house is sleeping a lot, kind of being lethargic, and they're being confronted, you know, for being a lazy person when their mom died 3 weeks ago, and they're just going through grief. So rest is a very important thing that we need to give people the freedom to kind of pull back and to rest at times. Then it says, all at once an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank, and then he laid down again. So the next thing we see God doing is that he gave Elijah food. And food is a very important thing in grief. And today, I think it's so much easier because we've got like food trains online we can provide for people. For a lot of the college ministry people, we suggest just giving gift cards. But when you think about what we want to help people in grief do is to take stressors away from them. You know, if someone's in a ministry house, my advice is always take them off dishes. Just trying to figure out when to do dishes can be so stressful. And with food, it's like you got to figure out, well, what am I going to eat? And then I got to go to the grocery and get it. And then I got to prepare it. And it's such an overwhelming event that sometimes people then just won't eat, which is makes things worse. So food is another baseline way of comforting people. Then it says, the angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. You know, I remember in the past reading this verse and being kind of confused, like, what was the angel doing? I always had a vision of the angel with this stick, and he's like kind of like poking Elijah, saying, get up and eat. Come on, come on, get on with it. But as I studied this through the lens of grief, I think that what was happening here is God ministered to him in physical touch. You know, there's a lot of research that says hugging, physical touch, is so important for people, especially for children. One thing I read said that you need to have at least 4 hugs a day to make it through a day. I don't know about that. But physical touch is important. Now, we live in a Me Too, you know, society, and so I rarely, if ever, you know, hug a female. And I never hug anyone without asking their permission first. But it's pretty rare. I can think of only one instance when I ask a guy if it was okay if I give him a hug that he kind of, you know, was leery about it. But now when I hang out with him, he initiates hugs with me. And there was another guy who was, I think he was 22 at the time, and the first time I asked him if it was okay if I gave him a hug, he almost started crying, and he told me that his dad had never hugged him. So physical touch is a real important thing, especially for kids. All right, let's move on. It says, he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by the food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. So God had him travel for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, God could have spoken to him right there under the broom bush. He could have, like, jettisoned him across the desert. But I think what God did here was he gave Elijah time to process. He gave him time to think through all that was going on. And he kind of fit into my pyramid. You know, first he's comforting him with food and rest, and now he's giving them this time to process all the things that have been going on. Now, 40 days and 40 nights is not a recipe that we apply to other people. Like, okay, it's been 42 days now. You need to get up and start moving around. But I think we need to allow people that time. And then the word of the Lord came to him. What are you doing here, Elijah? I think it's very interesting when God asks these questions. Like in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve were kind of hiding out, and God's like, hey, what's up? What's been going on? It wasn't that God was ignorant and didn't know what was happening. God knew what was going on with Elijah. And Elijah replied, he says, I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too. So by asking that question, what was God doing here with Elijah? I think he was giving him the freedom to vent, to kind of get things off his chest, to kind of talk things through, to mourn what he had been experiencing. And I think we need to give people that freedom to vent. You know, you might be talking to someone in early stages of grief, and they're going to say some pretty wild things. They're going to have some misconceptions about, you know, God and themselves and their events. And we need to hold back from trying to fix them or correct them. Certainly, if they're talking about damaging themselves or somebody else, we need to step in. But a lot of times, we just need to help them think through and ask more questions. Because sometimes when people say something, have you ever had this experience? You say something, and it's like, oh, I can't believe I just said that. And things kind of get clarified. You don't need anyone to correct you in that situation. So then the Lord said to him, go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu king or son of Nimshi king over Israel. And anoint Elisha son of Shaphat to succeed you as a prophet. So what's God doing here? He's giving Elijah a ministry opportunity. And I know in our fellowship, we talk a lot about one way to get out of yourself, to get out of your depression or your anxiety, is to go out and serve other people, to look for ways to get you to focus off of yourself, to serve other people. And I think that's very important. But it's not what happens in the early days of grief. You notice that when Elijah was sleeping on day one, on day two, on day three, the angel or God didn't come and poke him and say, get up, I got some work for you to do. Get out there, get the focus off yourself. You know, start serving other people. That he gave him that time to process, to vent, to work through the situation. And then he said, anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, to succeed you as prophet. And I think here he gave Elijah companionship, gave him a buddy, someone to hang out with and talk with, to get out of that isolation. Isolation can be good when it's for reflection, when it can be for talking to God, but when it's isolation is there for avoidance, we want to help people not avoid. But we also realize that sometimes people just, they want someone to be around them, but they don't necessarily want someone to talk with them. Just to be, silence can be very important. One example from my life is my first week of law school, my best friend from high school, now I've got to start getting emotional, died in a motorcycle wreck. And it was really hard for me. And I went to the funeral, to the church, and there were his parents, like, up in front by the casket. And I knew I had to go up and say something to them, but I didn't know what to say. And so I just stood in the back of the church for a while, trying to get my strength and understand. And a good friend of mine came up and just stood next to me. He didn't say anything to me. He didn't put his arm around me or anything. He didn't even look at me, you know. But he just stood there until I got the strength to go forward. And I tell people that his standing in silence helped me more than any words that were said to me that night. So just being a companion, being with someone can be very helpful. And then, if you remember, Elijah said, I'm the only one, everybody else is gone. Well, God points out to him, I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him. So what's God doing here? He's giving him perspective. And that's what we want to be able to do with people, is help them have perspective, specifically the eternal perspective. But again, it's not what we do on that first day. Too many times, I think we jump to this question about, oh, what is God teaching you through this situation? What can you learn through this situation? I actually had a guy a couple months ago I hung out with, and he had had some grief. It wasn't from death, but from a couple different situations. And as we're talking, he said, you know, the question that he got asked most by his roommates was, what do you think God is teaching you through this situation? And it had only been 2 weeks, you know, since his grief-producing event occurred. And as we talk through this, you know, I'm like, God might not teach you anything from this, you know? And that you need to focus in on understanding, why is this so disruptive for you? You need to process through. And he came back later and told me that he felt like so much pressure had been taken off of him, because he's spending so much thought in trying to figure out what God's teaching him that he couldn't really process his own grief. And so, you know, this eternal perspective that we have, you know, in Revelation 21 shows us that he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away, something that we can look forward to. But to hear that verse on day one, on day 10, on day 30 of your grief, we need to be very careful how we use Bible verses. In class last week, I have a whole stack of sympathy cards that I think are terrible, because they're cards that say, be strong and courageous, you know, and when you're in grief, you don't want to be strong and courageous. Now, that can be a good verse for later on, a good idea, or verses, you know, people in grief tell me one of the verses they hate being told is Romans 8:28, that all things are going to work together for good. And we know that that's true, but when you're in grief, it doesn't feel that way. And so that's a verse of urging or encouragement and not a verse of comfort. So again, with the pyramid, we need to start off in comfort. Nancy Guthrie, the woman I was telling you about earlier, she says the very definition of grieving with hope or grieving well is to have taken hold of the confidence that this life is not all there is. And we want to work with people to eventually have that perspective. So this kind of summarizes, if you kind of look at this from the pyramid, I should have flipped these around, because the rest, the food, the physical touch, the time, are all that baseline of the pyramid of comfort, you know, the freedom to vent, and then the urging becomes less from there. So that's kind of a summary of the 10 hours I teach in the class on how to help people. But I did want to take questions, because I'm sure you'd, yeah.
So are any of these in the encouragement row? Like, what's in the encouragement?
In the encouragement row, and again, I should point out, with the pyramid, it's not like you go from one step and then the next, that they go back and forth. But I think the encouragement point, urging is like, you know, you need to come to home group and you need to participate. Where comforting, a woman who spoke at our class a few weeks ago talked about how after her dad died, it was very hard to go to home group. And so she'd always sit on the perimeter, or she'd sit on the steps going up to the second floor, so she could go up to her room if she needed to. But eventually she slowly worked her way back to normal seating. So she needed that comfort of having an escape route in case she felt weird. And so encouragement in that situation could look like, when she did kind of make it back, to be able to say, man, it's kind of encouraging to see that, you know, a month ago you weren't able to come and last a whole home group, but now you are, you know. To be able to encourage people, there are fine lines. I've tried to come up with a list of verses that kind of divide, because a lot of verses are urging, but I think being able to encourage people about God's love and how God does want to care for them, that those are comforting and encouraging. Right.
And then, yeah, oh, good. Like, almost like, I don't know, it doesn't diminish the good. Yeah. It's like, okay, that should take the grief away. Not take it away, but the perspective of, oh, you're going to see them again.
Yeah, if you have the sheet on one of the myths I think we talk about, is that sometimes if someone's lived a long life or they have a strong faith, you know, a good friend of mine, his mom died a couple weeks ago. She's 93. And it's so tempting to say, well, she lived a long life. You knew she wasn't going to live forever. But we're not grieving, you know, that we're grieving that they're not here, no matter how old they are, or whether they're in heaven or not. We're grieving that they're not here with us. Now, we do have a lot of discussion about grieving someone that you don't know went to heaven. You don't know had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And I have another little clip from Nancy Guthrie. If you just Google Nancy Guthrie grieving non-believers, she has a good little discussion about how we just have to trust God, that God wants everyone to go to heaven, and he's going to do everything he can to get that person there. And sometimes we just don't know. And so, yeah, we need to watch. Another thing is that most times when someone says, my dad died, my sister died, my friend died, the first question out of the other person's mouth is, well, how did they die? You know, we want to focus on their death, and I think it's better that we focus on their life and we ask questions about that person's life. Like, what's your favorite memory? Because on one level, it doesn't matter how they died. They're dead, and I'm grieving them. And sometimes, if you don't know, it could be awkward. I'm an attorney, and we're trained not to ask questions that you don't know the answer to. So there's several people from our college ministry who have had someone die very traumatically and very, you know, for different types of suicide, different types of accidents. And by asking, oh, how did your dad die? And your dad died from suicide, you don't want to have to relive that and talk about it. So one thing we do with college ministry people or everybody is to give them that freedom not to talk about it. You know, we're in a fellowship that really values openness and honesty. And when someone says, how are you doing? Or what's going on? You feel the pressure that you got to spill your guts and say everything. And there are situations where you need to say, you know, today's kind of an okay day. Last week was pretty rough, but I have to talk to you about it sometime. Or, you know, I've already talked about it with two or three people today. Can we talk about something else? To have that freedom not to have to explain yourself.
I love what you just said, because in the sense that it goes both ways. The thing is that, you know, a lot of us don't know what the right thing is to say.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if somebody walks up and says, you know, how are you doing? You know, how dare you say I'm doing? What do you think, how am I doing? You know, I just lost my loved one. What, you know, this is offensive. No, he's trying to reach out. He's trying to translate the intention.
Right. And that's something that we do talk about. Now, in the initial stages of grief, you know, it's hard to do that. But you do want to get to the point where you take on the responsibility of educating the other person. You don't want people to walk on eggshells around you and just not say anything. I've had several people just in class Wednesday night, someone talked about that they'd rather have someone say something stupid to them than not say anything at all. Because too many times we just don't know what to say. And so in those instances, that's what I say. It's like, man, I don't know what to say. You know, I feel bad for you. I feel bad that you have to go through this situation. And even the phrase, I'm so sorry for you, can be misinterpreted. Because, like, why are you sorry? Because you had nothing to do with this event. But I think when you add on, I'm sorry that you have to go through this bad circumstance, or I'm sorry with you, you know, in going through this bad circumstances, it is a lot better. Did you have something else? Yeah. That's why we have the good grief group for younger people, because grief is progressive. And like, I've seen this happen a lot where you have a female who's lost their father. So they don't have someone to walk them down the aisle when they get married. They're not even dating anybody yet, you know. And so this is a future grief that when they do get engaged, then that grief really comes to play. Or when your parent has died and then you have your first kid. And so a secondary loss is you're down a grandparent. You're down a babysitter. You're down someone to ask advice, like, how do I do this and that? And so that is progressive grief. And so, yeah, those are things we try to talk about to help people realize. And so when we were talking about secondary losses, I do have people write down, like, okay, now that your mom's not here or your friend's not here, what's different? What are the gaps there that are going to need to be filled? And how do you think God might fill those gaps? You know, how can I as a friend help in those situations? So yeah, there's a lot of progressive grief. Even for myself, I mean, my parents lived to be in their 80s. But then after my parents died, I got a pretty huge promotion at work. And we were at, there was a swearing-in ceremony and everything. And I saw these other people walking in with their parents beside them to observe. And it was very rough to think how excited my parents would be to be here to see me do this. And so, yeah, there is that progressive grief that comes up. And we have to acknowledge it, you know, and to realize that that's natural. Because I think you're going to be grieving a loved one pretty much until you die. You know, there's always going to be something, but we want to incorporate that. Dr. Wolford, one of the things he points out is sometimes people use the term recover from your grief or resolve your grief, and those are two words that imply that you're back to normal. You've resolved it, you've recovered it. But instead, we need to use the word reconcile your grief, where reconciliation is where the two things need to live side by side, the joy and the pain. And so grief reconciliation is more of an appropriate phrase. Yeah. It is a difficult situation when someone doesn't feel grief. I feel one of my goals in life is to make people feel grief and to be sad, you know? And it depends on the situation. You know, there's a situation I have right now where there's two brothers, one's 17, one's 15. The 17-year-old is really grieving. The 15-year-old, I don't think he's developed emotionally yet to really understand all the consequences. You know how our brain develops, and like we don't prosecute teenagers as criminals because their brain hasn't developed, except in certain circumstances. But I think emotionally, as we develop, that things come. And so it is important to keep tabs and to keep looking out. Sometimes people say, well, I didn't have that close of a relationship with my dad, or I haven't seen my dad in 20 years, so it's not. But what happens when you lose a parent that you didn't have a good relationship with or you hadn't seen in 20 years? You lose that hope that someday you will have a great relationship with that parent. Paul Tripp talks a lot about this on the grief videos, about his dad and stuff.